Welcome to the Sea Mask podcast. We discuss modern masculinity from the perspective of Christianity. And today we're going to be looking at the story of Job, which is a story about suffering and how it can help you grow as a man. So we've all lost various things as a group, whether it be jobs, reputations, friends, family members, and eventually we're all going to lose our lives too. And you have to think about that. That's the ultimate reality check. So this is a great story, I think, for presenting some of the most countercultural messages in the Bible about being a man. So my plan is to go through a few paragraphs that I wrote on Job for my Substack, and then you guys can just come in with discussion points whenever you feel like it. So let's kick off with the opening then. It's about patience, I think, ultimately. Despite being a man of outstanding piety, Job loses everything, his possessions, his children, even his health. By provoking Job to curse God, Satan wants to see if Job's piety is rooted only in prosperity. Yet Job patiently endures all his afflictions for God's sake. And whereas Job was only admired by the angels before his trial, afterwards he is feared by the devils. Trembling before him, they realized that God allowed Satan to test him to grow in holiness. No pressure, no diamond. I love that point about how after he's been through the tough times, not just the angels, but also the devils fear him. Can you guys think of a tough time that you come through that you feel has actually made you stronger as a man or helped you to grow in virtue? Tim.
Yeah, I mean, anything I've ever faced that involved real fear, that's, I mean, sometimes you face a difficulty that doesn't involve fear, but anything involving fear, and for me, that's always health that I face down, I know, making me more formidable as an opponent to the demons. And that's kind of precisely the way I've thought about it the last year or so. So that's, I think that's, I've forgotten that it's phrased that way in the story of Job.
People don't want to go through things that make them feel afraid, though. It's so common today to try to avoid things that are scary the whole time. Mike, have you ever really deliberately sought something out because you were afraid of it and put yourself in a situation for the discomfort?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is moving my family to where my wife was raised and just leaving my entire family, friends, business behind. I just felt this prompting, you know, from the Lord one morning. And I said, I've lived a life of, you know, too much comfort. My home and my gym and, you know, where I was raised are all very, very close to each other. Everybody knew me at the time as somebody that would never leave East Vancouver. And I certainly thought the same thing. And when I had my first daughter, you know, I was working all the time. I wasn't there with, you know, with my family, wasn't there with my wife, wasn't present. I wasn't a good dad, wasn't a good husband. I was a good provider, but that was, as we know, that's merely just like the barrier to entry when it comes to being a father. It's just one of the many hats we have to wear. And so I woke up one morning and I decided less than a year after purchasing our first home, I said, we're going to sell this place. I'm going to carry my family on my back. We're going to build a house where my wife was raised so she could have more familial support while we were raising our family. And I had no idea how I was going to rebuild my business or, you know, my income streams, what have you. I just decided I need to get out of my comfort zone and I just need to embrace the role of patriarch over my family. And that was one of the most difficult decisions I've ever made in my life. Looking back, I mean, the way that I make it sound, it kind of sounds simplistic, but it wasn't at all for a guy like me. I was so used to being where I was at. And so, anyways, we moved and we were staying with my in-laws for some time. And I gave myself, after we moved, I gave myself 3 or 4 months to rebuild a six-figure income before we took possession of our home. So it was just like ass to the fire, you know, full faith in God that he was going to provide. And he absolutely did. So praise Jesus for that.
I love that anecdote because it's about being willing to let go of possessions, not being too attached to them, like a home, for example. And you see that in the saints' lives, very wealthy men giving up fortunes to go and do something for Jesus instead. And I think that's one of the main messages in Job too, not to become too attached to anything on earth, even people, which is one of the hardest things to learn. But yeah, that idea that you could just detach yourself from a comfortable life that you'd built up and then go elsewhere, and you grew as a man as a result, right?
That was looking back, for the year of the end of 2022, all of 2023, I moved here in June of 2022. I thought it was the worst decision of my life because I was going through trial after trial. Karen horrifically miscarried at the end of 2022. I was dealing with a really bad issue with alcohol. I was lonely, all of these things. Now looking back, that was the greatest decision I'd ever made in my life. I wouldn't have come back to Catholicism had I not made that change. That for that reason alone, it was the greatest decision of my life because I had to face the discomfort. I had to face the music. I had to face the reality that was so far outside of my comfort zone that I had nobody but God to rely on. That's
Yeah.
it. That's it.
Providence is active in all the little details of your life, and even what can look like material desolation. Aquinas makes this point. God will allow material desolation if it's going to work towards our spiritual benefit. And that's really what the story of Job is about. Nick, this idea that people have a piety that is rooted mainly in prosperity is something you see in the Protestant mega churches a lot. I think there was that clip that went kind of viral on X and Instagram recently of Mark O'Driscoll, is that his name? Talking about how it's difficult to admire a guy who's broke, right? And how he had a problem with Catholic priests because of that. Presumably a problem with Jesus too, who died a broke virgin. So that just got me thinking about how people link piety to prosperity so powerfully today, and what God is doing with Job by stripping him of all of that. Do you find that too? Have you noticed that the piety prosperity link is made?
It's usually Catholics can avoid that. I don't know if it's the Catholic guilt thing or a more sincere work ethic, using that phrase, not in like the Protestant way, but just like an understanding of works as having a meaningful impact on your salvation versus just by faith alone. I mean, I've seen up close and personal the prosperity Protestant belief system. And when that's your orienting reflex, when that's like your Jack Sparrow compass, that you're just supposed to go where the money is. I it's shocking that they could read scripture and ever get the Protestants could read any part of scripture, Old or New Testament, and think that prosperity is a data point for virtue or holiness. It's kind of basically every parable I'm aware of, again, Old and New Testament, Job being the oldest book in the Bible, and then like everything that Jesus discusses, it's the opposite. What's cool is that the Catholic Church does teach that being rich isn't sinful. Like you're allowed to be prosperous as a Catholic, or I should say, it's not contrary to the good life, or then it won't preclude you from entering heaven. Christ just makes it very clear that it's the attachment to it, that the moment he asks for it, you have to be willing to let it go.
Yeah, really important distinction to make there. It's okay to be rich. It's just very often spiritually dangerous to be rich because you can become attached to it so easily. And it's every young guy's dream to hit that six-figure income, maybe even more than that. Six figures is kind of small fry nowadays on social media. You want to hit seven, eight figures all before you turn 30 and become that high value man. For some people, that might be the worst thing that could possibly happen to them, right? N nothing worse could happen to them in life. You take a guy who might already struggle with lust, for example, and then you bump his income to that. And the amount of women who are not the type that he should be having anything to do with, who are going to be tempting him, are going to become overwhelmingly tempting. And that's an easy way to go to hell. Most people end up there through lust. That's just one example. So stripping things away, making things harder for yourself, spiritually good for you. Hey, Nick, you mentioned it was easy to avoid this trap as a Catholic. I still think, though, that there's a level on which, just as a man, it's a very difficult line of thinking to avoid. And the culture encourages us to really see that. Mike mentioned this as like barrier to entry, provide materially. So the idea that when things are going bad, maybe someone's business is going into liquidation or they get fired or something, and they're not doing well financially and their family's suffering because of it, the idea that that could be a time for growth for everyone and getting closer together, that's just so countercultural. I think it takes real courage as a man to have that mindset. And Aristotle talks about one of the main tests of a good wife being someone who's actually there for you through adversity like that, right? That's the real test of a marriage.
I just think people have to the entire story of Job is God takes Job on like a whimsical LSD trip from 2001: A Space Odyssey at the end, and basically challenges him. He's like, what in the world do you think you know? You weren't there when I made this. You don't understand the first thing about running. Like, have you ever made the sunset? Like, do you know how mountain goats graze? You don't know shit about any of this stuff. And now you're trying to explain how the universe works, whether it's just or it's unjust, whether my ways are correlated to your behavior or not. And God basically says, like, just stop. Stop trying to ascertain this. What's interesting though is at the very end, God says that Job spoke rightly, and he tells Job's friends that they were wrong. And Job's friends were the ones who were trying to say that Job either sinned or God's not just. Job was the one who was wrestling, which is God basically says you're a lot closer by trying to struggle with this than the other groups of people who had come to conclusions, which is to say, my ways are above your ways. But I was, just cutting your interview for What a Woman Is. It's always funny. I've told Tim this before. Like, whenever I make a documentary, I spend so many hours like looking at somebody else's face, but they don't spend that amount of time looking at mine. So it's this weird. Like, I felt like I knew Tim really, really well after The Greatest Reset, but he had only seen me like a handful of times because I spent like 40 hours just like staring at him on my computer screen.
Which
But their story with the lecture and how that resulted in your termination, that's not correlated to your virtue, at least not in the sense of a punishment. And I think it's in First Peter. Paul talks about getting punished for your virtue. So how does that make any sense? He says that the what is gained by the man who's punished for his sin, but there's so much more to be gained for being punished for your good works. So how does that make any sense? So it's just the whole message of Job to me seems like God imploring us to just put faithfulness first and stop trying to use life experiences as the only data point to determine if God's happy with you.
right. You've actually mentioned the next point I wanted to bring into discussion. Tim, this will be a question for you because we'll need to get into the theology of it a bit more. You guys have pretty much mentioned everything else I wanted to say on this. So, in the next paragraph, I wrote that our culture prizes comfort, but historically, cultural decadence has always preceded decline. Soft times make soft men. That's why the saints sought out hardship. Jesus went into the desert to overcome the devil. and Christianity advises men to deliberately make things harder for themselves, you know, fasting, etc., taking on penances. So the idea is that suffering can be medicinal. And that is why God sends it, not just to punish sinners, but also to perfect the just, right? Tim, can you tell us a bit more about how suffering can perfect the just? I can think of friends of ours who are really good men who have had suffering visited on them. And it just makes them even better rather than making them bitter, right? You can see it happening, unfolding right in front of you, that they get in new depths to virtue. How does that work? Yeah.
I mean, very almost no one who gets to heaven gets there straight away, meaning most folks that get there, according to some of the saints and visions, get that through purgatory. And the purgative process can actually begin on earth and shorten our time there. And that's, I think, the role of sanctifying suffering. So I don't think it's that many good men become better by suffering. For Christianity, the way is the cross, the Via Dolorosa. And the only way to really move toward immediate heaven or to lessen your time in purgatory is to move through the purgative on earth. And that means one thing. It means suffering. And also the thing is, our suffering seems narrowly tailored for our weaknesses. That's something that's really struck me the last couple of years. The, you know, our weaknesses, meaning our greatest spiritual blind spots, are usually what get attacked if the Lord loves us, if he's pursuing us. And he does pursue his guys more than others. You know, some of these, think of Andrew Tate, or I don't know, some of the, you know, tech billionaires. He's, from most intents and purposes, as far as I can tell, sort of giving them up to their success, condemning them with success. Whereas with men that he really loves, you see this in the Bible, he does not condemn them with immediate successes. He gives them periodic success, but it's always tempered with enough suffering to chasten them in the specific, narrowly tailored ways that they need to become truly what he wants them to be.
Yeah. Makes so much sense. Go for it, Nick.
Just the point about the narrowness, I think, is really, I kind of wanted to speak to that earlier when you guys were going around and saying the specific fears that you guys overcame or the challenges you overcame. You know, I'm in sort of a unique position without even reading Don't Go to College. I didn't go to college, and I started doing things that made me unemployable. So I can't actually get fired now. Like, you know, Tim and Will and AJ got fired for like standing on principle. I'm just unemployable, and I have been since day one. But I kept putting myself in positions where sort of like things I was afraid of was my compass. Like, oh, I need to go do this thing because it seems kind of terrifying to do. But all of those were very self-oriented and, you know, quixotic, like, oh, I'm a young man, I have all this latitude, I can do sort of whatever I want. Let me just go do some new exciting film project or go live somewhere cool. Even though it intimidated me, but that was not like tailored to my spiritual growth, but getting married was like what was required to overcome, what I had to overcome in order to get married was much more tailored confrontation of fear than making some new film project or like, can I afford, you know, my mortgage this month as a guy on my own? And so that narrowness that Tim was talking about, I think, is really interesting because it's different man to man. This is something Tim and I have talked about too, that like what is the boogeyman for one guy is like doesn't even make another man flinch, and vice versa. And so those specific phobias, and I don't use that just in a psychological way, I say that spiritually as well. The thing that you're recoiling from confronting, as Tim said, if God loves you, he'll bring that monster out from under the bed and make you face it. And it's suffering that brought, this is what's so interesting about Job, is if Job kept being prosperous, and he was prosperous in all ways too. It's interesting how the Old Testament characterizes that. It wasn't just that he had like flocks of goat or sheep or whatever it was he had, but he also had a huge family. He had a big family, and like he was really well suited in his community. So he was prosperous in like perfect eudaimonia. He had like the good life, and he was righteous, and he was well favored. So like this guy wasn't, some debaucherous guy who won the lottery. Like he was a good man who also had everything that he needed. But then when he suffers seemingly unjustly, Job is so vexed by it that he says, there's like three sections. He goes and talks to his friends three different times and is kind of dissatisfied with the conclusions, to the point where he's like, I literally want God to personally come explain this to me. And what's so amazing about that is it was the suffering that inspired Job to move closer to God. But I don't know of many people, many situations where success inspires you to move closer to God. I personally know that, like, the moment the things that I'm anxious about or suffering with, when they lighten, is when I sort of reflexively forget to do all of the things that I know I should do with my spiritual life. And Ripperger talks about this too, that you should be wary of consolation. Like, if you're getting consolation in prayer, in spiritual life, it's probably because God's still training you like a dog to do the things that you should just do no matter what happens in your life.
One of the greatest Mike Tyson quotes is that the devil came for him when he was at his strongest, not his weakest,
Yeah.
right?
And then he
Came at
said,
his
you have to
strongest.
leave with who you came with. One of the coldest lines I've ever heard Mike Tyson say, you have to leave with who you came with.
Now, it's such a countercultural message, though, that suffering should be something that we're actually grateful for, because we're told to pop pills to take it away. Oh, you're in pain? Let's make it stop somehow. Go to therapy, go to counseling, distract yourself with Netflix, take ayahuasca or whatever it is. But Christ came to elevate suffering and give it a deeper purpose, not to eliminate it from our lives. So the idea it's a gift that we should be grateful for and appreciate what it can do for us, that's probably the way in which Christianity is most opposed on a really fundamental level to the message of secular liberalism. So for people looking around themselves at the world thinking this isn't right, well, where can you find a message really staunchly opposed to that, that's even stronger than the idea that you'd be grateful for suffering, you let it transform you? Now, Nick, you mentioned there about having flaws targeted in a kind of precision, pinpointed way, that point that Tim mentioned. That's the next thing that I want to bring up in a bit more detail, because Job was a good man in prosperity, but he wasn't a great man, right? He wasn't a great man until the fires of adversity burnt his minor flaws away. Mike, like me, like Tim now, actually, you help guys with their marriages. And one thing I've noticed is that it's not just the monster under the bed that God uses, but sometimes the person that you're actually in bed with, right? He uses the flaws of your spouse, like the defects of that particular person. Those are also the ones that you need to grow in holiness. And you don't have to have something big, like what happened to Job, happened to you to be able to benefit from the kind of message that we're talking about today. It's in the people around you, in the little things that you have to go through day to day as well. So using myself as an example, I can be very uncharitable and impatient sometimes. And being part of a big family is a good way to be able to combat those flaws. I'm sure a lot of guys find the same thing with their own particular vices, with their wives, with their children. Could you speak to that topic a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, personally too, and you know, similar to what you just mentioned, I'm an incredibly selfish and greedy person, but that is like fundamentally an enemy of being a good father and a good husband. What plagues like modern man is a kind of spiritual effeminacy that, you know, doesn't allow them to actually fully confront this. And this is what something that that's enamored me so much about Catholicism is that nothing requires more of you when you're actually practicing it, practicing it properly, you know, going to confession and humiliating yourself and choosing penances, choosing to fast, doing all of these things. And I tell these guys, hey, listen, like, you know, this might sound cheesy, but you either, you know, choose difficulty, like a real, in a real redemptive way, not just go take a cold plunge just for the sake of it. I mean, spiritually, really confronting these things that irk you. So for me, it's being patient with my wife or tithing or not being so selfish with my time. Or trying to be present, et cetera. You know, it could be a very beautiful, slow martyrdom process. But the fact is, we live in a culture that fundamentally does not know how to exist in the tension of facing these defects and facing these attachments. So what I tell any guy is, you know, at a base level, dude, if like if you're out of shape and you have no temperance, you've got no semblance of fortitude, and you're struggling in your marriage, first of all, you got to get right with yourself. You got to face these things that you've ignored for so long, and you need to actually voluntarily pick up the cross, because I think what's really plagues society now is a spiritual sloth that is the enemy of virtue.
For sure. One thing I was thinking
One
about
thing about
there, and Tim, this would be a good question for you actually, because I think you've got the biggest social media platform out of all of us. One thing I think God is doing with Job's suffering is not just benefiting Job, but also helping him become a model for other men to look to about how to handle this. So yes, it increases his reward in heaven. But it also becomes a way to help other people get to heaven as well. And thinking back to when you lost your job, or the fact that so much of your intellectual life in particular is lived out on podcasts and in public, in books, how do you see yourself as providing a role model to other men about how to live out a Christian life? Because that's what these stories in the Bible are really about. We're supposed to look to them as examples, live like that, and then give that example to other men too.
It's interesting because I was looking for an article that an interview that I did for The Blaze to see whether or not it popped up. And so I don't Google my name very often, but most of the articles that came up were about me having been fired in the news section anyway in 2020. And for me, it's like a distant memory, but I guess if people look to my name, still, one of the most prominent things is being one of the first firings in the BLM summer here in America. So it did make me think along those lines that, you know, you have to, if you're going to be the sacrificial lamb, you know, the way our Lord was, you have to try to model it well, how to go through it and not, I mean, like you did, well, not ask why, if you can, at least not publicly, and say, okay, that's fine. I'm going through this, and I want to make it exemplary. So I mean, of course, the private sufferings that come, you don't have to show anybody. And Job has some of the private details of his life exposed in his suffering. So we're unlike him that way, Will, you and I. But it's easier for us to just to give a forward-facing, nod. Okay. Amen. I accept this suffering as it comes to me publicly.
Yeah, it's important for guys to see other men not just retreating into a corner to cry when something bad happens to them. Like, oh, you got fired? Well, here you are doing fine, and you're still helping people out online. You didn't let it break you. So I think that's a good thing. that can come out of these tough situations. And the thing about Job that really gets me is that even in the middle of it, when it's at its worst, he praises God, right? The Lord gave, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. If you can get to that point, even when something you think is terrible in the moment happening to you, then you've really got that strong confidence. And every now and again, you'll see in the paper these super successful, amazingly rich businessmen, and something bad happens, like a deal goes wrong, or they get sued, or whatever, and they shoot themselves and their wives and their kids. It happens more frequently than you'd think. And when I was a kid, I didn't really understand what was going on with that stuff. I thought maybe the guy's, insane, or there's some other explanation for it. But the more I think of it, the more it's to do with the idolatry, right? The sin of being so attached to those things that even when they're gone just for a moment, you think your life is over. And compared to Job, they are effeminate. Right? No matter how successful they might be in some of the metrics of masculinity, that's an effeminate attitude. And I just want to read out this paragraph from St. Augustine's City of God to help us understand why. Any of you guys jump in after this with anything that stands out to you? Like a good servant, Job counted the will of his Lord his greatest possession. And through obedience to that will, his soul was enriched. It didn't grieve him while he was still alive to lose those goods, which he was shortly going to have to leave at his death. But as to those feebler spirits who, though they cannot be said to prefer earthly possessions to Christ, still hang on to them with a somewhat moderate attachment to them, they have discovered by the pain of losing these things how much they were sinning in loving them. For their grief is of their own making. In the words of the apostle quoted above, they have pierced themselves through with many sorrows. For it was well that they who had so long despised these verbal admonitions should receive the teaching of experience. It's just such an amazing paragraph. You could read that again and again all day long and still not get to the depths of it. Just to recap on a couple of things. So, the will of the Lord was his greatest possession. Like, let's start with that. Mike, you were nodding away.
Yeah, I mean, in the greatest times of suffering for me, and even this is before even I became a Catholic, I found myself flat on my face worshiping God. You know, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. And even as I guess an ignorant Protestant at the time, at least I had a couple things that right in that regard, knowing that God loves me so much to take away these things from me so he can guide me directly to him or closer to him. And you know, it sounds so meathead, but that's the language I speak. You know, everybody, I don't know if you guys have seen the YouTube video of Jocko Willink talking about, you know, good. If something bad happens to you, whatever, what, good, good. That's kind of the attitude we all have to take with this stuff. It's hard. I can tell you for sure. It's difficult as a man with children, growing family, to detach yourself away from material success. And I often reflect on this conversation that I had with Nick in the car. I've probably mentioned this several times on the podcast, so you know, bear with me. We were talking about scaling a big business and earning seven figures, what have you. And Nick looks over at me and says, "God loves you way too much to give you that." And he's absolutely right, because that, maybe in the position I was then, or maybe even now, that would corrupt me. What would that do for me? I'd gain the world and lose my soul. And so the first thing that came to mind, or comes to mind when I think about Job, is he knew where his riches really were, sorry, and they were in heaven, not anything he had on this planet. Although he was wrestling mainly with his flesh, he knew exactly where his riches were stored, and that was with the Father. And still one of the most chilling verses in all of Job to me is like, "Where were you when I formed the foundations of the earth?" You just imagine how you would take such a statement if our Almighty Father said that to you. I wouldn't, I don't even know what I would say, but yeah. Job is one of my favorites for that reason.
Yeah, For sure. I like the idea that God loves you too much to let you have it. I've forgotten which psalm it is, but, or is it in Proverbs? Lord, make me neither rich nor poor, because you're probably not spiritually strong enough to handle wealth or poverty. Like the saints can handle poverty, but you'd probably end up committing some crime because you can't cope with it. So you don't want either of the two.
That's
The
such
other
a
big,
humble grace.
yeah, it is. Yeah. The other thing here that was big for me is that Job isn't grieved to lose what he was going to lose soon after death anyway, and keeping that in the back of your mind at all times. And the pain that you feel when you lose things or even people can give you, according to Saint Augustine, like a reminder of how much you were sinning in loving them in a disordered way. That insight just cuts so deep. Tim, what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, that's a tough one because when we're comfortable, we don't think that we're sinful, sinfully violating the first commandment by putting other things in front of God. But maybe that's the easiest commandment to violate. I mean, that's what Saint Augustine seems to insinuate here. That, I mean, if the level of suffering that Job went through was necessary for an already good man, then it must follow that the first commandment is the easiest to violate. It almost follows like a syllogism. You know
That's
what I
great.
mean?
Yeah, the great insight. And I'm just thinking that's also because as men, we are built for worship. So we are always tending towards, because of our concupiscence, making idols of things, right? Worshipping God is what we're supposed to do, but we're disordered in that way that we make an idol of something else. So that's why it's so easy to violate the first commandment. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but I think that's true.
Yeah,
Well,
yeah,
that
yeah. Heart's an idol factory, as John Calvin said, as he idolized the congregation he was calling church. It's a great, great term, though.
yeah, Nick.
That Augustine quote, how much they were sinning and loving them, also once again speaks to the seeming recommendation to decouple both pain and pleasure from the will of God, that it's not data, it's not meaningful data indicative of your performance if you lost your family. But if Job lost his family and was so aggrieved that he then curses God, then it's like, okay, so you're worshiping your family, then you're not worshiping God. So, and then, but the same is true in reverse. You have a windfall, you brought the right meme coin in crypto, and overnight you have, $50 million. This has happened to people. I've watched this happen 100 times. Somebody buys something, forgets about it, they wake up and they have hundreds of millions of dollars before. That's also going to be revelatory for what you worship. Like, do you stick with what you know is true? The part here that's obscure to me, Job counted the will of his Lord his greatest possession, and through obedience to that will, his soul was enriched. That sort of makes it sound like Job knew what the will was, which like nobody ever does. We don't go through, it's not like we go through day to day with the game plan, like the bullet pointed list of what God's plan for your day is, and we're just like, oh, I don't like that. I'd rather do this instead. Like, it's, we have no idea most of the time what the story is supposed to be. And so that seems to mean that what you have to have is detachment from everything except God. Like, you can't be attached to success or failure or people or anything, because like you don't know. And Mary's fiat, be it done unto me according to thy word, is a really good example of that. And then I can't remember which saint, you guys probably know, who referred to herself as the plaything of Christ. Maybe it was Saint Therese. But those sorts of characterizations of us as like just playthings, like we don't have a singular say in any, like, we should basically just be happy to be here. And that's like such a ridiculously high bar. Like I have never considered what Tim said, that the first commandment is the easiest to break, especially in comfort, like when we're not suffering. And maybe that's why God affords us so much suffering, is in the absence of it, like we would literally never pay attention to him.
Yeah.
Like if he didn't continually remind, pausing our next breath, we would so quickly forget the order of things.
Practically speaking, though, because I know if I was listening to this, I'd go, okay, I totally understand this. And I only have so many anecdotes that have personally worked for me. How does somebody rid themselves of these attachments? How does one detach? So for me, practically, with regards to, let's say, greed and finances, giving money away and being generous and charitable, it makes me very uncomfortable. And so that has been my practical work against that vice of greed, right? Or let's say when I'm feeling particularly gluttonous with food, it's fasting that helps me to grow in temperance, for example. How does one, I mean, is it simply just embracing sort of the sort of inversion of that vice, the virtue, obviously, that is so uncomfortable for you to face? Like, what is it like in your guys' experience?
I think that's primarily it. So you look at what your biggest vice is, and then you look for opportunities to practice the virtue opposed to it. And you're also frequenting the sacraments, and you're pleading with God in prayer to give you the grace to overcome it. And you're being vigilant as well. Like you're on the lookout for it. Like Jesus says, stay awake. If you're not awake, then you're going to doze, get comfortable, complacent, and then things will become more disordered. But I think that idea of actually being proactive, Mike, saying, I know this about myself. Here's the area I need to grow. I understand the principle, no pressure, no diamond, or the pearls formed by abrasion, and that suffering and hardship is good for me. So I'm going to look for opportunities in life to make myself feel uncomfortable in those ways that I know I'm bad. Right. That's got to be the starting point. Tim, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that was basically my answer. You're looking for the virtue to oppose whatever vice it is. And again, this is where the narrow tailoring comes in. If God, I don't know how providence works exactly. None of us do. Sort of like none of us understand the will of God in real time. But if God loves us fervently, then He will actually help us to cover our blind spots. And that's why the suffering that he sends me will be different from the suffering he sends Nick, will be different from the suffering he sends Mike and Will. And that's what we meant earlier by narrow tailoring. I mean, yeah, you should stay awake and look for it yourself. But because I think the first commandment is so very easy to violate, as the story of Job illustrates so well, you don't have to be a sleaze bag to be sort of asleep. And that's why the narrow tailoring comes in, and he sends us virtue that he sends us suffering that conduces to the building of muscles that are especially weak in us.
Yeah.
I think to that end, then, if somebody feels like they haven't been suffering a lot, they haven't lost a family member, they haven't gone through a financial hardship, lost a job, interpersonal conflict, something like that. Remember Ripperger saying something people could do for Lent was praying to their guardian angel to be humiliated once per day during Lent. Just have the guardian angel do something that humiliates you once per day. And I remember that being one of the scariest prayers that I prayed last Lent every day. And it works, by the way. That absolutely works. Every day, a little thing, just a little embarrassment where you're just like, okay, all right, just we're going to keep moving past that one. I would imagine the same sort of prayer works with asking God for providential suffering. Something tells
That
me he
works
would,
too.
yeah, something tells me he would oblige you with that if you really feel like, you know, you've been too comfortable. I was going to make a joke when, you know, Mike was saying how he was combating his attachments, because one of these attachments is to the family And so I was going to joke and say, well, kill your family. And then I remembered Abraham was literally asked by God to kill his son because that was his prized attachment. And so, like, my glib joke, I realized, like, no, actually, yeah. I mean, don't, yeah, please don't kill. That's not me saying kill your family. I'm just saying, yes, like, there's no limit to what God is justified in asking of us. It's goodness gracious. Like, this is, it feels so glib to even talk about all these things because, like, then somebody actually like loses their family and just everyone kind of like stops, climbs out of the ivory tower, and it's just like, gosh.
Yep.
Okay.
And
We could philosophize all day long, but.
with the point St. Augustine was making is that it you might think you can philosophize all day long, but he says that God's going to send you the teaching of experience
Yeah.
because you can't just learn it in the book because it won't go deep enough. So it's coming. And the devil's line next, as you'd expect, is so devious. So he says, okay, look, you've taken all this guy's possessions. That's not that tough. Let's take his health. Skin for skin, and all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thy hand, touch his bone and his flesh, and then thou shalt see if he will not curse thee. So when he comes for your health in particular, an example I gave here was, you know, the gym bro who thinks that his self-worth, his identity is really tied to his body fat percentage or his numbers in the gym, whatever it might be. You know, maybe he thinks that his piety is connected to that, and that's his kind of prosperity rather than the bank account. Touch his bone and flesh, and you'll break him too. Like, that can also be an idol, the personal health and performance, all the rest of it. And that's also a kind of effeminacy. And there are health scares that people can have that shake their faith to the core more than anything else does, more than a financial crisis. So actually letting go of your own health as an idol. And Plato, I think, was it Plato, Tim, described philosophy as preparing for death or learning how to die. I think that's right. In a way, the whole Christian journey is about that too. In about learning to detach yourself, even from your own life and health. And you guys, I admire the fact that you've been quite open about your anxieties with your health. Let's talk about that briefly. So, the idea that the devil thinks after Job's possessions have gone, the way to get him, like the next level, is going to be to touch his bone and flesh. Mike, you mentioned being anxious about this before.
Yeah, and it really comes from a an attachment, and much like Tim, to my family, and not wanting to leave them and leave them alone, and then the fear of the unknown of what suffering awaits me, how long and drawn out and agonizing it's going to be, and it's kind of like the unknown, and this it comes down to also just a I'm used to being in control of every aspect of my life, and so when there's something that's this unknown, we have this especially guys like Tim and I. We have this tendency to want to just get that right down to the bottom of it. But understanding that with something like hypochondria, which I've struggled so much with, I know Tim can relate to, there's almost like never getting to a bottom of it ever. There's never a 100% concrete answer. And as close as you come to that, all of a sudden there's something else that presents itself. And now you're going down this different rabbit hole. And what that comes down to is just over attachment to being in control and over attachment to family. And an aversion to suffering and the unknown, and it still creeps up for me. And I know for me, what I know helps me is my biggest curse when it comes to hypochondria and it becoming sort of inflamed is this thing right here, my phone. Because what I'll do is I'll just go down the absolute rabbit hole when it comes to symptoms. I'll be palpating every aspect of my body, every part of my body, scheduling appointments with doctors. And what has helped me is precisely not doing those things. So what it's taken is, again, something that I've taken from that time I spent with Nick, was how he quit smoking was, making a vow to the Blessed Mother never to smoke again. And so that's essentially every single day when I'm struggling with this desire to Google something, go down a rabbit hole, schedule an appointment with the doctor, what have you. I'll vow to the Blessed Mother that I'm not going to do that. Because now if I break that vow, now I have to go to confession. I'm in mortal sin. I've made that personal vow. And that helps. But that's the closest thing to like controlling it that I've come. But I'm curious to hear Tim's thoughts on that. But that's all that comes to mind for me.
That's a great point that is connected to your fear of leaving your family without a husband and father. I think that's a really a noble fear. It's not just losing your own health. It's what they would lose if you were sick. Tim, if you got anything to add to what Mike was talking about there, I think it's a really great point that the devil brings up here, that this would be the way to take it up a notch.
Yeah, it's so much scarier than financial or even bodily excellence as privations. And I'm a little older than you guys, and I'm a little, me and Mike have talked a lot about hypochondria. The real bugaboo is when you're a hypochondriac, the way Mike or I struggle with, and then you do get chronic conditions, you know, that's one I haven't quite figured out, chronic pain conditions. That's a bad one. And that's one I'm kind of been going through the last year. So, the philosophy and life itself are training for death. Theology is training for death. And this is a bigger one to give up. Cause if you love your family and you are kind of like Job, then, it's a far bigger ask than to give up your Ferrari or to give up having huge muscles. I mean, I just, even people watching the channels noticed like, you know, weight fluctuations I had over the last year. It's difficult. It's really difficult when you're just like, I don't need to be my physical peak. Like I'm 43. I want to get a little bit of comfort. That's a harder one by tenfold, by a hundredfold, to call, oh, well, that's superfluous comfort, the way it is if you're a young guy trying to get wealthy. It's a bigger test.
Yeah.
But still a test.
For sure. And the point about family that you guys have both brought up there, I mean, Job's wife ends up broken by the loss of her children, right? She succumbs to Satan. She doubts God's mercy. She doubts his justice. And she's tempting Job to join her. And Nick mentioned earlier that his friends are also assuming that he must have sinned to deserve this to happen in his life. And then the really great moment comes, and this is an example of the power of the intercession of saints, when God tells Job to pray for his rash friends, and then heals his body and restores double what he had lost, right? There's a real lesson there in praying for his friends because of their rashness. So not only is he not made bitter by the suffering, but he's actually looking out for other people while he's going through it too.
Yeah. I still think we shouldn't take that as a data point either, that he was restored double, because it wasn't like, okay, so you're saying I can avoid suffering then if I pray for my friends? All right, cool. That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. I mean, if you look in my, I don't have a hypochondria. I have plenty of other EAs and OSISes. I guess if you were to put a DSM-5 characterization on my idolatry of health, it would be orthorexia. If you just look in my medicine cabinet, like that's a sin right there. Like the amount of supplements I have, because I think it's going to modulate how I feel and improve my well-being. And like the time of research that I've spent over the last 8 or 9 years is absolutely idolatrous. And as Tim and Mike were talking about the fear thing, I had this insight that, you know, there's probably some formative childhood experiences that can be pointed to explain where phobias or Things like hypochondria might come from things that parents said or experiences that you went through, things that you saw. And what's so interesting about that is that means that your parents can basically curse you to worship not God. That they can fail and I'm trying to figure out the best language for this here, but like they can redirect your attention for the next several decades of your life toward fear and away from God through their failures. And as a result of this, like, because if it is the case that things like mental illness or idolatry or
Okay.
if what Augustine said is true, that the pain is data of idolatry. It's indicating that you are loving something disorderly. What causes that direction of the heart and the mind towards something that isn't God to a disordered degree? Well, it's not like we're trying to, like all of us are trying to love God. It's like we're compelled, we're terrified. It's like an appetite. So like, how do you get that appetite? Well, it seems like your parents can inflict this on you through their own failings or their own ignorance. And now you have an appetite that's idolatry, basically.
Yeah, the four wounds of original sin, ignorance, weakness, malice, concupiscence, of course they affect us all individually, but original sin also has a social component to it as well, in
Right.
that you're born into a society that's going to encourage and cultivate all kinds of disorder as well. So you get young kids who are being taught stuff in school, or being given the idea from what's strictly speaking legal in a given culture that it's also moral to act that way. So it becomes harder for them to make the right choices because their intellects are weak, their wills are already weak, and you're also being prodded in all kinds of bad directions too. So I think what you're saying is exactly right, Nick.
Like, what's the difference between a parent who doesn't teach their child sufficiently about chastity and, or maybe even represents an unchaste lifestyle, and that child then has an appetite that's, disordered, and kind of what we're talking about here, and what's upsetting, and, I don't. I'm not raising a kid yet, but you guys have all done that several times. Is it seems like how when you're less than 10 years old, each moment kind of has tremendous significance to you, even if it doesn't seem that big of a deal to like the adults, like, mom yells at you because you didn't do the dishes right or something. And to her, she's like, I just had a long day. I'm really tired. Like, it didn't mean anything. And to you, that just like ripples for the rest of your life. And now you are oriented toward all the wrong things.
I've heard it described by some priests and spiritual writers as being this way. So human nature is like smoldering embers, right? And you've got to be careful what you put close to it. And some of this stuff that you're describing here is just like throwing gasoline onto those embers, and then suddenly it's ablaze. So the tendencies are already there, specifically towards breaking the first commandment, as Tim pointed out. And you have to be so careful about the way that you bring that person up. Otherwise, it just gets worse and worse. So, the main point I wanted to underline here from all the different examples that we've discussed is made better than I can make it by St. Basil the Great. His comment on Job's story was just this: be perfectly assured of this, that though the reasons for what is ordained by God are beyond us, yet always what is arranged for us by him who is wise and who loves us is to be accepted, be it ever so grievous to endure. So that's the main message for anyone who's listening and is going through something that is challenging them in any of the ways that we've been describing today. Thanks for your insights, guys. It's been a really informative episode to listen to. I hope people find it helpful, and we'll be back with another one next time. God bless everybody.
God bless you guys.
God bless y'all.